Oh, sorry about that, Earth Explorer. Sometimes we have technical difficulties. That's the wonder of live webcast radio. We have to rely on the integrity of the internet. And by the way, we're being bombarded by a very high solar wind right now and a geomagnetic storm, which definitely can have an effect on this kind of radio. But that's why you tune in, because it's free and unfettered. My guest tonight is Neil Kramer. He's the author of the great book, The Unfoldment. And I just asked Neil about the hive mentality. We humans tend to fall into it so easily, and we were talking about the structure of various governments around the world and how the people, although held up to, as he said, very iconic standards from around the world, that's begun to change in the last little bit, and we were just discussing that. So continue on and tell us about the hive mentality and how we drop into it so easily.
Well, in Europe, people have been accustomed to being told what to do for 2,000 years, really, by kings and queens and different religious figures and so on. And this, we have this state of feudalism where, you know, really, people, the vast majority of people in the island of Great Britain, of Scotland and Wales and Britain and Ireland, these people were kind of told what to do and how you lived, how you ate, who you married, how many children you had, how your house was constructed, what kind of money you earned, and so on. All those things were very, very tightly controlled by the church, basically. And in anyone who's done any sort of medieval studies, it's a very well-known fact that it's not just an idea, it's a fact that the church reached into everybody's life in a very radical way. In the States, it's not really quite like that. There's only really 300 years of history here, if you stretch it out, in terms of how we understand America today, and certainly in Northern America. That means that a lot of people in America are not accustomed in quite the same way to be being told what to do and being told how to think. They think, well, I'm going to do what I want to do. And we have this Bill of Rights, and we have this documentation that constitutes the Constitution and all those different things. And it is quite interesting to take a look at that. There's certain aspects of it that are kind of nonsensical nowadays and being terribly flouted, particularly on the East Coast, with the First and Second Amendments in particular. But there are other elements of it that are really interesting. And the fact that it has to be defended at least makes anti-human legislation more difficult to proceed. In Britain, in the 80s, we had two shootings that were, a guy with a gun goes out, shoots a load of people in a rural area, and then a while later, another guy went into a school of little kids and shot a load of those, and then killed himself. And pretty much from that point onwards, Michael Ryan and Thomas Hamilton, the names were, when those two guys did that, firearms were totally removed from the English landscape, completely and utterly. You cannot own a pistol in England now. Olympic marksmen have to practice outside of their own native British country to compete. That's how silly it is. Having a shotgun, that'll be the next thing to go. So even that's very difficult. A normal person can't really own a shotgun anymore. That, again, it's not about the hardware. It's not about having weapons and being a survivalist nut job. We're not talking about that. What we're referencing is the principle that they symbolize something, and it symbolizes a submissiveness and an acquiescence to a power outside of yourself.
Sure.
And the contrast that I've seen in Britain and America has really called that to mind. And just, you know, going into Walmart here and being able to, you know, buy, you know, a Remington 870 and like a big case of 12-gauge ammo is hilarious to a British guy like me. You know, you go and buy your shotgun shells and some bacon and, you know, some eggs and milk at the same time. It's really funny. And to Americans, you think, yeah, so what? What's he talking about? But Europeans will laugh when they hear that. because it's a very stark reminder that some of the things that should be the choice of every man and woman, like do you want to have the ability to defend yourself, that choice has been taken away from British people, completely taken away. Now, knives, you can't carry knives in England anymore. Any offensive weapon can land you in prison overnight without any questions, really, and you just get charged and spend the night in a cell. So that kind of thing is very, very important to watch out for. And although my personal work is very philosophically orientated and spiritually orientated, actually, in about 2005, when I started to publish written essays, they were about this political control and the sinking of Europe into this fascist dictatorship, which seems, you know, a bit conspiratorial and a bit like negative language, but it's beyond any doubt, really. You know, it really is. It's not really something we argue about anymore. So my path was, well, why does that happen? And fundamentally, it brought me to a realization that there's a very distinct connection between, you know, when things get very grim on the outside level and you get all these dark figures and this control and this lack of human liberty, it's a representation of people not doing their work on a spiritual level. And so when you disavow your truth and your righteousness and your honor as a man and woman, when you choose not to evolve spiritually and just enjoy the pleasures of life, you actually create a shadow in the world. And the difference between my conception of that and Carl Jung's, for example, is that I think it's very literal. I think we actually create negative circumstances by disavowing our own path. And yeah. So this book, The Unfoldment, is an attempt to say to a mainstream and a, you know, initiated audience, as it were, both those sets of people, look, this is really important and it's really interesting. And when you engage with this unfoldment, looking at the world in a truer way, you know, uncovering some of its mysteries, and a lot of the things that you talk about, you know, are also very personally interesting to me, you start to realize that actually it's a more fulfilling and rewarding way of life, and it's much truer to what we actually are than just trying to feather our nest. So, you know, the book really approaches like 23 different angles on that, represented by each chapter, to say, well, let's look at different aspects, different phenomena, different philosophies, different things to do with extraterrestrials and crop circles and whatnot, and thought beings and tulpas and shadow entities. You know, those things have a reality. Those things have an impact on the world. But so does culture, so does parenting, so does politics. And there's a connection between the two. And that's what the book attempts to draw a very clear bridge between, to say, don't assume that having an interest in the phenomenal aspects of the world, you know, the really exciting mystical stuff and, you know, some of the things inside the Earth and some of our friends in other parts of the galaxy, don't assume that that is entirely removed from what goes on Capitol Hill or what goes on Downing Street.
In your book, you write, the biggest secret of the control system is that it requires our consciousness to function. If we stop believing in it, it falters. And then you go on to say, by recognizing our own sovereign power to create reality and actually exercising it, we disconnect from that which is unreal. I really like that.
That's the key thing in that sentence is, we hear so much about creating reality and conscious co-creators and all this kind of stuff, and that's true. But unless you exercise that power, mm-hmm. unless you actually make it part of your felt experience in the real world, it doesn't change anything. It's like being aware of one of your own problems or one of your own hang-ups. You can be aware of it and articulate it and write it down on a piece of paper for 50 years and it won't change. You actually have to act. You actually have to do something different. And I think that's the threshold that so many millions of people are arriving at, and including people, you know, unexpected sorts like mums and dads and brothers and sisters and stuff, who have lived very normal, conservative lives, shall we say, and have bought the sort of mainstream paradigm, those people, I would say, in increasing numbers, are starting to question it and say, I don't really believe David Cameron and Barack Obama anymore, and I don't think that voting for Mitt Romney and voting for different types of representation will make any difference. They're so removed from the conversation, the human conversation. And as I said at the conference recently, they have disrespected us, they have dishonored us, and they do not represent us. And that means that you have to question what your vote is about, and you have to question how that works in your local community. You have to look at that. You can't just make a blanket statement. You have to take that decision for yourself. More importantly, however, it says, right, well, if that isn't working, what do we do about it? What do we actually do? How do we start to create a different way of doing things? And that starts with your own consciousness, with how you think, with what media you imbibe, with what people you speak to, with what you wear, what you eat, what you listen to, what you create, what you consume, everything.
I would maintain that the reason Britain expunged all firearms and are now doing knives is because of the consciousness of fear from those two individuals that abused the law. Now, in our country, we would pull the rabbit out of our hat and say that the government actually put these two guys up to committing these heinous murders, so that they had the excuse to go round up all the weapons, and the people would let us do it.
Well, that's a very interesting line of inquiry in itself. Michael Ryan, I would say, it's difficult to say. There's such a scarcity of information about it. Thomas Hamilton, on the other hand, is a clear case of a PSYOP, clear case. And there's some very, very high-level involvement with the government and paedophilia and all kinds of funny stuff. So they kind of crushed two problems with the same blow, in that they got rid of this guy who could, you know, expose some senior figures in British politics. And it was the kind of death knell of personal firearms ownership. So they thought, let's do this. And if you start to analyze that case, and I did a little bit in some of the essays on my website some years ago, when you start to look at it, there's some serious problems with the official story. And it's things like that, of course, and so many other examples that I know we could list, and 9/11 and Operation Northwoods and the burning of the German Parliament building and Roman shenanigans. You know, all governments sponsor terrorism on their own people, always and always have done. And when you look at that and seriously ask that question to yourself, the only answer is that they're not representative of the people. It doesn't work like that. So you have to create something new. And you start that with thought, and then you transpose that into your actual deeds, into what you do. So that has a powerful effect. And go into places like East Fetty in Trout Lake, you meet people who do things differently, who live differently. I've met people in Montreal and in Tennessee and in Washington and in Oregon who don't use money, who don't use credit cards, who don't use driving licenses, who don't use taxation. They don't engage in that transaction anymore, and it's very radical. It's like, well, how do you go about things with no money? How do you drive a vehicle with no license? Well, people are doing that in increasing numbers, and you can learn about what that means and what it represents. And the fascinating thing is, even these guys who are dealing with sovereign law and true law and the deconstruction of false law, they are quickly coming to the conclusion that at the heart of it is a spiritual evolution. So one of the guys who we were graced with the presence of at the conference, Spencer Barclay, he is a spiritual guy. He might not know it completely. I don't know. You know, I've only known him a short while. But what he's suggesting in his exposition of law and how to deconstruct it and what is unreal about it leads to a spiritual observation that man is his own authority and there's no authority above him, because that authority within him is divine in its essence.
I couldn't agree more. I was going to ask you a question. We're coming up about 10 minutes, 15 minutes before the hour, and we lost about 5 minutes there. Would you like to stay for 5 or 10 more minutes past the top of the hour? I was going to ask you, Neil, do you own a television?
No, I don't.
And I think you told us at the conference that you'd done away with your television. How long has it been since you had a television in your home?
Well, I've lived in the last 6 homes that I've lived in. I've never had a television, so it goes back a long way, probably to about 2006, 2007. So it's been a while. And even when I did have a television, I did not have a television license, which, again, ridiculously in Britain is compulsory. I didn't have a television license because I didn't watch live broadcast television, either cable or satellite or whatever. And that has just been removed from my life. And that has an impact, you know, a very positive impact. And I'm always banging on about this to people, you know, get rid of your television set.
Oh, yeah.
There's other ways of doing it.
We can't tell the difference between propaganda and the news. We're jerked and pulled on an hourly basis by a huge propaganda machine of the mainstream media. But I cannot believe they have enough intelligence to make the stories up that they do. I watch the news and I listen at the same time. Many times what I see on the news and what the bleach blonde is telling us with her perfectly white teeth glinting in the camera lights are two completely different things. What I see on the camera behind her is not what she is saying. She's reading something on a screen, but a picture is worth 10,000 of those, you know, bleach blonde words, and it's not what she is talking about. So
that's a serious gap in what's real and what's not real, and more people are coming to that conclusion and stopping, you know, this kind of 21st century addiction to the news. You know, people who watch Fox and CNN all day and listen to it on the radio in the car and listen to it at home on the internet, people are kind of starting to withdraw from that because, again, there's a realization that it doesn't really represent life. It's not that those things aren't real, but it's why is Syria such an agenda item when 100 times more people are being slaughtered on the coast of the African continent every day? Why isn't that in the news? Why is that agenda very specifically targeted at a perceived paradigm shift in the near and the Middle East? Why is that? And any geopolitical observer will say, well, because it's preparation for some political stunts that are going to be executed in the East. And our friend Mitt Romney has just been over to Jerusalem and has been chatting with the guys over there saying, look, I'll properly back you. If I get in and if you use your massive lobbying powers and if you, you know, pull a few levers when the votes start coming in November, I will properly represent you. And that kind of political, you know, Manchurian candidate, awful Henry Kissinger 1960s politics is just so unpalatable nowadays that I think people are finally just pressing the off button and thinking, I just can't look at that anymore. I can't physically look at it anymore. Let's do something different. Let's choose what the agenda is. What is the news for my community, my county, my state, my country? What is the real news? And so I think, again, discussed in the book, is an increasing empowerment that people have realized that they've got now, which is you can create your own news by syndicating, if you like, your own feeds to different news sources to look at the things that are relevant, that are fair, that are balanced, reported by Europeans, by Americans, by Arabs, by Africans, by Orientals, whatever. All that stuff, you can formulate your own agenda. Don't expect, as you put it, that the bleach blonde who's parroting the agenda from a think tank is going to give you anything that's relevant to real life. It's not going to happen. You have to do it for yourself.
Yeah, you're exactly right. You've got to take control of that. And the first part of that is realizing that you're being fed a line of crap. Once you follow the money, once you see what's going on, I watched a film called Watchers 4. It was produced by L.A. Marzulli. And the most telling thing about this film, and of course there are many in the film, but one of them was one of the most powerful ones, was an Israeli attaché to Benjamin Netanyahu, who was being interviewed. And he plainly said that they had been approached by the White House to not attack Iran now, even if it's imperative that they do so, that they have to wait until 2 weeks before the election. And you can't attack after the election because then there'd be no political use for it for the president. But the fact that the president and Israel had made a deal that the president would not back them up if they attacked Iran when it was not politically valuable to the administration. That's the kind of stuff people need to hear. That's the kind of interview people need to see so that they have this awareness, this awakening that this kind of stuff is going on. That what you're hearing on CNN and MSNBC and Fox News is a watered down, prefabricated copy that is sent to them by some head office and then repeated throughout the day every 24 hours. Once you realize that, you can create your own news.
You can, and the interesting thing about what you've just said is the ramifications of it, because if 300 million Americans understood that the government do not represent them at all in any way, shape, or form, then what does that mean for millions of American troops deployed around the world? What does it mean for young men and women who are putting their life on the line for something that is a miscalculation, essentially? Defending the homeland. They think they're doing something for liberty and freedom. Obviously, we appreciate that. And I'm quite happy to thank people for that service. However, that is a miscalculation. If people understood that, what would it do to the corporate entanglements with government? What would it do to the Walmarts of this world? What would it do to the Targets of this world? They are in this just as much as anyone else is. It's not just the sort of, venture capitalists and the people building underground tunnels. That's the kind of sexy stuff. But the absolute normal grocery store, the Texacos, the Chevrons, the Shells, what would it do to that if people understood that all that is kind of fake? So when people get a glimpse of the ramifications of understanding that the government don't represent you, they turn back and think, that's too weird. I don't actually want to know. I'd rather not know, and I'd rather live in the Matrix and just forget all about it and just have a nice shiny car and a huge television. That's the problem people face. And just as in the movie, it's like Morpheus said, it's a problem when you take someone out of the Matrix later on. If they've been exposed to it very heavily and been saturated in its conditioning, it's actually dangerous to take people out. So to some extent, I've always felt this, you have to leave people to it, because they will come around in the end, probably not in this lifetime, but in my cosmology, there's no time frames, there's no limits. Death is just an exit, not an ending as such. And people will find out for themselves in the end. So more importantly than trying to wake people up is speaking respectfully and lucidly and knowingly to those who have already woken up, who are already on the brink of waking up. So let's not try and rattle people who are asleep. No point in doing that. You can only really wake yourself up. However, there are millions upon millions of people who are waking up to the truth of life. And it's a spiritual game, not a political one. And all the politics and all the cultural fabrications, they're the first thing to melt away. They're the first thing that dissolves, which I think is rather nice.
Yeah, I do too. And I think that one of the things that frustrates groups like the Bilderbergs is that try as they might, push their money and their influence and their contracts and their underwriting abilities and their currency trading abilities around as they might, they can't control the human race. And it's because millions of people are waking up. They are seeing the light. And an awake, sovereign people cannot be controlled that way. And so they're actually losing control of the human race. And hopefully, enough of the human race wake up that it becomes like the 100th monkey. It becomes like a critical mass. We have a mass awakening, and we have this allergic reaction, and we vomit out all of these corrupt controllers, and the Republic is then
returned. Purge ourselves, yeah, from them. Well, I see it like that a little as well, in that if you imagine a map of Europe or Britain or North America, wherever you are, and I see like little lights in my mental image of this, little nodes that light up on the map, and you need a certain number distributed evenly in a certain manner across the whole of these continents, and when and every other continent as well. But when you have a critical mass of that, a threshold of consciousness, you don't need everyone to wake up. You just need a certain number. And when that happens, it changes the fundamental rules, and it does away with this delusion, as far as I'm concerned, that anybody was ever controlled as such. You can't really control the human race. All you can do is persuade them temporarily that they're powerless. The reverse is true, of course, that human beings are tremendously powerful and have awesome, world-changing powers, every single one of us. If you persuade somebody over centuries that that's not true, that's the only trick they've got, really. That's the only thing that they can do, which is why I say that they need our consciousness to fuel that illusion. When we withdraw our consciousness and our attention and our honor from them, then that transaction, that contract is broken in a good way, and you kind of replenish your psychic self, you maintain your spiritual integrity, and you start to actually create something. You're not just running around trying to make a better life for yourself anymore. You're just doing something true. You're not worried about them. They don't scare you in the same way anymore. We scare them.
I like that. I like that, that you're doing something true, which, by the way, this awakening, this rejecting of the predetermined pattern for humanity, this unfoldment of your own sovereignty has nothing to do with wealth or ownership or accumulation of things or money. It has to do with doing things that are true, that are great, and you don't necessarily have to finish them. You just have to be in the act of doing them.
Yeah, you do. And like you say, it's contrary to a lot of ways that we're brought up to think. And if you listen to the sort of Rush Limbaughs and Sean Hannitys and people like that, everything they do is based on mercantile exchange. It's all about making a dollar. And the sovereign power of a spiritual man completely destroys that paradigm, completely dissolves it. And it's nothing to do with commerce. It's nothing to do with being a merchant. We can do those things as well, but they are not the center of our life. They are something we do to make resources move around in a smooth way. That's what they're for. That's all they're for. But to imagine that a successful man is a multi-billionaire merchant of some description, it's not the sort of life that I would ever want to lead, and it's not the sort of life that the men and women who I respect and admire, they don't do that sort of stuff. They do something else.
Well, to be fair, I think both of those men, Sean and Rush, would respect the desire of that person to not accumulate wealth. That they're not pushing that everybody has to do it. What they're pushing is that everyone has the right to do it, the freedom to do it, if they want to. No one's forcing them to do it. The issue is that somehow government, and I'm not talking about the elected government, I'm talking about the agency government, has set themselves up to prevent people from realizing whatever it is their dream is. if they want to open a laundry or if they want to start an electric car company. It is the determination and will of that person. And it is not the government's job to stand in the way of that person and say, no, you will not do this.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very practical observation, and I tend to agree with it myself. There is definitely a problem with the current administration in that they are hell-bent on turning socialism into an acceptable political maneuver in America, and they're repackaging it so it's more tasty, and they're shaping it to be something unifying and something harmonic and something human and something compassionate. It isn't really. It isn't really about that at all. It's about handing the power to a central source. So just as, you know, conservatism gone wrong turns into fascism, socialism gone wrong turns into communism. When communism and fascism go to the extreme, they're the same thing. It's a circle. They all come back to the same point, which is a sort of plutocracy, essentially. That's what it's all about. And it's always been like that. And again, people who know my work will have heard me say before that there is only one party, there is only one empire, and there always was. And it changes its garments, and it changes its colours, but there's always one empire, and that empire never ended, as the author Philip K. Dick once said in his novel Valis. The empire never ended. So you were looking at it with American robes on, but it was British, it was Chinese, it was Roman, it was Egyptian. It's the same empire doing the same tricks. Mm-hmm. And that reign is coming to an end. And they're frantic because they don't know, just as we don't know, quite how it's going to play out.
Well, that's kind of the fun part, you know. Liberty and freedom is kind of messy sometimes. It's not it's perfect. As I said in my presentation at James's, you know, these kinds of governments are set up to give you free food and free clothes and a free place to live and the freedom to work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, so that a few can become billionaires. Everything is free except you.
Yeah, that's right. I remember seeing that. That's a very powerful image, that. And I think I saw a little Apple Mac logo tucked away in some of those images, and we'll say no more about that. But that is a very important observation, and I think it brings again the issue right into our felt experience, right into our hands, as it were. That real wealth is about choosing what to do with your own time. That's what wealth is, and it's not about money, and it's not about investing in a future. There isn't a future. There is no future. There's only this now. Future, past, don't exist. There is only this. And if this isn't working, and you delude yourself into thinking that you can stretch that out for 50 years, then that's quite an anemic and meager existence. Far better to take the plunge and say, well, if we are infinite beings, if we are eternal divine souls, if we are on this adventure, then let's make it an adventure. Let's take risks. Let's do things that support the evolution of ourselves and the universe. Let's not do things that are untrue. And that is the compass bearing that you really can't go wrong with. Focus on what you know is true. And what's true for you becomes truer for more and more people as you increase your spiritual attainment. So it is relative what's true. But as you zoom out, as you become more conscious, as you increase your spiritual fidelity, as it were, that truth encompasses more and more and more until it becomes more universal. So the universality of your truth is dependent on your spiritual insight. So if you're dumb, your truth, your circle of truth is very narrow. If you're a wise man, it's a very large circle. And that's what we're talking about here. And that's how human beings are built to live. It's quite natural to us. It's not some superhuman feat. It's what we do. We just have to kind of recollect it and remind ourselves and, you know, pick that old bicycle up, get on it, go down the path, and you think, oh, yeah, this isn't as bad as I thought. This feels pretty good, and I know how to do it.
Perfectly said. I love that. So if you're a sculptor, go buy a lump of wet clay. If you're an artist, by all means, get your brush in the acrylic or the oil. If you're an engineer, let's get to it. Songwriters, the same way. Remember how to ride the bike. Remember how to do things true. Because Neil's exactly right. At the end of all this, the only accounting is with yourself. Did you get to be yourself? Did you get to do what you dreamed?
Yeah, wow. I couldn't agree more.
Well, Neil's book is called The Unfoldment, The Organic Path to Clarity, Power, and Transformation. Neil Kramer is a super fine author, published by New Page. I highly recommend the book. You can get it where? Amazon, Barnes & Noble, everywhere where fine books are sold?
Correct, yeah.
Do you have a special website so if people buy it from you, they get it autographed, or is it just stores only?
No, if you go to neilkramer.com, there's various outlets that you can get it from there. If people want to get it autographed, there's different ways of achieving that. You can write to me through the website. I'm always happy to do that. Any event that people come to, obviously bring it along, and I'll sign and do whatever I can. But yeah, it's widely available happily, and New Page have done a good job with it, so I'm very pleased with it.
Yeah, they did a great job with it. I would love to know how they get the title of the book on the left and the title of the chapter on the right in the headers. I've always wanted to know how to do that. we self-publish authors have to struggle with the programs like Word, which won't do that. Where are you speaking the next couple conferences coming up?
The next thing I've got is a workshop over at our favorite place, Isete, which is August the 25th. So anybody in Seattle, Portland, Salem, Eugene, anyone, Northern California, anyone who can make that journey, come along to Trout Lake in Washington State, to James Gilliland's Isete Ranch. Join me there for a workshop, and you're pretty much guaranteed to have a great weekend. Yes, you can hear me waffle on for the day, but also the previous night, that night, the next day. It's just a fantastic place to be. A lot of interesting people you'll meet. You'll make some new friends, change email addresses with people, swap details. It's a great place to gather and to discuss the kind of issues that you and I have talked about tonight. So that's the next one up. I also do a lot of teaching work as well, so most of my travel is actually one-to-one teachings with people, and anybody who wants to know more about that can find out at neilkramer.com.
Excellent, excellent. Thank you so much for coming on X Squared Radio. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Thanks for inviting me. I very much enjoyed it, and my best wishes to you and to Robin, too.
Oh, thank you so much. All right, have a great rest of the week. Take it easy and be safe, and I know you'll be true.
Okay, you bet. All right, you too. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Neil. Bye-bye. All right, Earth Explorers, let's take a quick break. We're a little bit over, and we'll come back right after this. That was Neil Kramer, the book Unfoldment. I know you're going to like it. I loved it. See you in a few. Welcome back to Hour 2 of X-Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, coming to you live from east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWeather window forecast, about 83 degrees. Clear skies. We're supposed to have a pretty bright moon tonight, but the Delta Aquaridge showers, meteor showers, are supposed to reach their zenith tonight. Unfortunately, I may be washed out by the full moon, but that's okay. I think you should still get out right after the program and see what you can see. And also, watch the skies. A study finds an increase in UFO sightings in Canada. This is mainstream stuff, guys. Although illegal aliens are an issue on our southern border, our neighbor to the north might have its own problem with aliens from another world. Ufology research reports that there were about 3 UFO sightings per day in Canada, with over 986 sightings total last year. The record for UFO sightings was in 2008, when a surprising 1,004 sightings were reported. The report, entitled the 2011 Canadian UFO Survey, states that the lion's share of cases being nocturnal lights, quote-unquote. However, a number of them were said to be shaped like boomerangs, spheres, and mysterious light sources. The traditional flying saucer-style UFO was only sighted about 3-4% of the time. However, most of the sightings were explained. Believe it or not, 8 out of the 986 sightings are considered high-quality unknowns, or cases with no obvious answer. This is much lower than the 3-4% of high-quality unknowns from previous years. Although the public believes that most UFO sightings are made by cranks, the study states that many of the reports of UFOs were pilots, police, and other individuals with reasonably good observing capabilities and good judgment. The report admits that the increase in sightings does not have a simple explanation, but it offers up a few explanations that are more down-to-earth. The increase in UFO sightings could be related to the growing awareness within the general population that there are agencies which collect UFO reports, and that there are more private websites allowing people to report their UFO sightings. Or just maybe there really are more UFOs physically present in the sky. Just interesting stuff. Just because you're measuring something doesn't mean that it's going to happen more, unless you're talking about statistics, then, of course, that does have an effect. And there's lots of stuff going on in the news. For instance, one of the amazing things that I learned this week is that in a scant 4 days this month, 4 days, the entire surface of Greenland's ice sheet melted to an extent not witnessed in 30 years of satellite observations. Now, the ice sheets on Greenland do melt from time to time, and I say that every 30 or 40 years, but they don't disappear in 4 days. That was pretty amazing. On average, about half of the surface of the ice sheet melts during the summer, but from July 8th to July 12th this year, this month, the ice melt expanded from 40% of the ice sheet to 97%. That's true. Thomas L. Mote said, I started looking at the satellite imagery and saw something that was really unprecedented since the advent of satellite imaging. Because you remember about 30 years ago, we were just barely starting to make satellite imaging of the North. Thomas says he's a climate scientist at the University of Georgia who has worked for 20 years studying ice changes on Greenland detected by satellite. While scientists described it as an extreme event not previously recorded from space, they hastened to add that it was normal in a broader historical context. Ice core samples taken from the summit of Greenland's ice sheet that shed light on 10,000 years of its own history show that a similar large-scale melting event happened roughly every 150 years. So because the previous vast melt occurred in 1889, this year's is more or less on schedule, she said. So it's not really that surprising. She says, Let's see here. I wasn't hugely surprised to see the news from NASA about unprecedented melting of most of the Greenland ice sheet surface. Much of Greenland has been experiencing record warmth since May, and on the 29th of that month, the weather station in the extreme south reached a positively balmy 24.8 degrees C, which is about 76 degrees Fahrenheit, which set a new world record. That's pretty darn warm for Greenland. The unusually warm conditions prevailed for much of June and into July, with the Danish Meteorological Institute website showing Greenland temperatures anomalies 2 to 4 degrees C higher than the 1961 through 1990 average. I could probably think that the mosquitoes in Greenland at 76 degrees would be so large that they could take a small poodle into the air. They have about 3 weeks to hatch, gain maturity, suck as much blood as they possibly can out of every warm-blooded thing that they can find, and then die. And I found that mosquitoes, under those circumstances, can be positively predatory. Also in the environmental news, we have just learned that storms, regular old 50,000-foot thunderhead thunderstorms, threaten the ozone layer over the U.S. Now, I know what you're thinking. The EPA is going to clamp down on thunderstorms. I know it. I can see that's what you're thinking. Strong summer thunderstorms that pump water high into the upper atmosphere pose a threat to the protective ozone layer over the United States, researchers said on Thursday, drawing one of the first links between climate change and ozone loss overpopulated areas. Didn't we talk a little bit about this last week? Oh, that's right. What we talked about was the coming global superstorm. You remember the book by Art Bell and Whitley Strieber, upon which the movie The Day After Tomorrow was based. We talked about supermassive northern hemisphere hurricanes, counterclockwise rotating superstorms that would pull super cold air from the stratosphere down to the surface and freeze it down to, say, minus 80 or minus 100 degrees. Well, now it appears that that model is not that far off, that these storms with these very high velocity 250 mile an hour winds are pumping water up into the stratosphere. Now, I don't know if you know what ozone is. Ozone's a word to you, but molecularly, it's three oxygen atoms put together. It's not O2, it's O3, and it's considered a free radical. That is to say, it has an extra electron on it. So it is extremely reactive, and it is especially sensitive to shortwave ultraviolet radiation in the UV, UVA, UVC range, which would be 325 nanometers, 315 nanometers, which you certainly wouldn't want to be exposed to because it's called germicidal. It not only would give you a terrible sunburn, but if you had your eyes open during that time, you would actually burn the cornea of your eyes. You would actually suffer eye damage and have to have your eyes covered, you know, for a week or so while they recovered, because you'd have a sunburn of the eyes, and it can even make you go blind. The worst part about, and the reason they call it germicidal, is because that wavelength dimerizes, or in a more layman's terms, shatters DNA. It takes it apart. It breaks it at those free radical spots in the chain. And more often than not, it cannot be put back together. It doesn't redimerize. Once that bond is broken, it becomes basically a polymer, and it no longer can replicate. So it does that to primarily bacteria. That's why they use it in operating rooms. They put the instruments in a special, not like an autoclave. I mean, they do autoclave them. That is very high temperature for a certain period of time to sterilize them. But to keep them sterile, they put them underneath germicidal lamps. This prevents bacteria from growing on them, and basically the ultraviolet radiation messes with the reproductive system by killing or shattering the DNA. Well, what happens is that when water is pumped up into the stratosphere, the H2O becomes vaporized, very, very small molecules floating around in the stratosphere that can't coalesce. That is to say, they can't form clouds. They can't form water droplets because the air pressure is so low up there. But what they do is they interact with O3 molecules, which dissolves, or should I say reacts with the ozone, and the ozone goes away. And the ozone, in order to be remade, has to be remade with things like lightning storms and a cosmic radiation. So that's why it's damaging the ozone hole. But in a study published online by the journal Science, Harvard University scientists reported that some storms send water vapor miles into the stratosphere, which is normally drier than a desert. And it showed how such events could rapidly set off ozone-destroying reactions with chemicals that remain in the atmosphere from CFCs, those are chlorofluorocarbons, refrigerant gases that are now banned, but nevertheless, they're up there by the hundreds and thousands of tons floating around in such a low pressure that they don't really run into anything unless you throw water into the situation. A risk of ozone damage, scientists said, could increase if global warming leads to more such storms. I would say, I would put a different word in there, not global warming, climate change. If these large superstorms continue to form and pump this water 15 to 20,000 feet up into the stratosphere, we're talking about 70 to 80,000 feet pushing this water up into the atmosphere, it will react with the ozone, which will dissipate. It takes a while to form again, sometimes years. Then that radiation can reach the surface. Not to worry a tremendous amount. You stay inside and or wear clothing and sunglasses, and then you don't have to worry about the ozone layer. But it's not us that I worry about. It's the flora and the fauna that are out in the weather that become affected and changes the ecology of the planet underneath where this shortwave radiation can come through. It's the union between ozone loss and climate change that is really at the heart of this, said James G. Anderson, an atmospheric scientist and lead author of the study. For years, Dr. Anderson said, he and other atmospheric scientists were careful to keep the two concepts separate. Now they're intimately connected. Well, there you go. All emails revealed aside, climate change is real, and as long as it's just water, distilled water up there, maybe we have one reaction, and you start throwing CFCs in there, and now you've got another reaction which permanently takes the ability to form ozone out of the upper atmosphere for a long time. Ozone helps shield people, animals, and crops from damaging ultraviolet rays from the sun, which are in the UVC range, I would say shorter than 345 nanometers. Not visible, but short enough to cause chemical damage, especially with molecular biology. While there is conclusive evidence that strong warm weather storms have sent water vapor as high as 12 miles through a process called convection injection, and while climate scientists say one effect of global warming is an increase in the intensity and frequency of storms, it is not yet clear whether the number of such injection events will rise. One of the things that the case that I made with the ionospheric breakdown with HARP is that you're pumping this energy, CFCs and energy and water vapor, into the stratosphere. And the stratosphere is big now. It's the stratosphere and ionosphere above the Earth are huge. They are anywhere from 8 to 80 miles above the planet, and they encompass a whole lot of volume. So it will take a whole lot of abuse. But once you pour that energy in, it has no way to get out. There's no way for it to discharge. There's nowhere for it to go. There's not enough voltage up there, difference in potential, for it to discharge to Earth and can't go out to space. So it just sits there and builds up. It will reach critical mass one day when we've poured enough energy into that layer and enough water vapor and enough chemicals in that layer that we form an ion path. An ion path is a little like Benjamin Franklin's string floating from the kite all the way down to the key in the jar. Once the ionosphere forms an ion path to Earth, it's over, my friends. There will be a lightning bolt of biblical proportions. Each pulse will be somewhere around 3 megatons in strength. And each pulse, rather than being as big around as your wrist, which is what a normal lightning bolt looks like, to something that's about a kilometer in diameter. Each pulse striking the ground will vaporize about 6 inches of solid rock every time it pulses. If it's true to form, same as a lightning strike that you can see with your naked eye or catch with a movie camera, it will pulse somewhere around 10 to 18 times a second. And normally when you see a lightning bolt go off between a cloud and the ground, you see the bolt come down with your eyes. It's following an ion path to ground. But then that bolt will pulse sometimes for 2 or 3 seconds until the electrons that are gathering to that ion path drop to a point where the potential between the cloud and the ground isn't high enough to make the jump another time and the bolt stops. By the time that happens, if the ionosphere decides to discharge to Earth, it could be 2 or 3 minutes with a pulse going off 10 to 18 times a second. Do the calculation. You have 180 seconds in 3 minutes, and if you're doing 3 megatons per second, or you're doing 3 megatons per pulse, and let's say you're doing 10 pulses per second, you get the idea. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds of megatons of energy poured into the ground in one spot by an ion path, a lightning strike that's following an ion path to the ground. Needless to say, the amount of material that would be exploded up into the atmosphere would be something like 50 Mount St. Helens volcanoes all at once. You're talking about major climate change, a major onset ice age, and this is what we're playing with harp. And not just our harp, the Chinese harp, the Russian harp, the harp in Antarctica, which may be multinational. I'm just telling you that that's the published paper. That's in the film, Holes in Heaven, that was produced by Paula Randall Jones and also directed by Wendy Robbins. If you get a chance, pick that up. Or wait for the new one that's getting ready to come out. Same producer, same director. We're going to make a new one that's going to be even better and has a lot of new information. Also in the news, there are a lot of blogs out there about energy and about its effect on the atmosphere. I'm going to skip through it here because we're about halfway through the second hour. You remember we have talked about from time to time spies, and we've made the comment that it's kind of an old word. We make movies about it and we read novels about it, but it's very real. For instance, one of the things that I recently read about and I'm going to share with you tonight is that a Russian spy ring aimed to make children agents. This is an AP story now by Devlin Barrett. Officials say Russian agents Donald Heathfield and Tracy Foley sought to groom son Tim Foley to be a spy. Yeah, now this isn't Spy Kids, is it? No, it isn't. This is real stuff, okay? A Russian spy ring busted in the U.S. not 50 years ago, not 20 years ago, 2 years ago. 2 years ago, planned to recruit members, children, to become agents. and one had already agreed to his parents' request, according to current and former U.S. officials. Now, what's the danger in this? What is the real downside to this, and why is this story so important? Oh, I'm glad you asked those questions. When the suspects were arrested in 2010, with much fanfare, I might add, official accounts suggested that they were largely ineffectual. New details about their time in the U.S., however, suggest their work was more sophisticated and sometimes more successful than previously known. One of them infiltrated a well-connected consulting firm with offices in Manhattan and Washington, D.C., by working as the company's in-house computer expert, according to people familiar with the long-running U.S. investigation of the spy ring. The effort to bring children into the family business suggests the ring was thinking long-term. Children born in America or reared in America were potentially more valuable espionage assets than their parents because when they grew up, they'd be more likely to pass a U.S. government background check. Oh, not only that, they would sound like us, they would look like us, they would dress like us, they have a valley accent. They would be, for all intents and purposes, you know, Xbox, PlayStation Americans, and nothing to fear. And it wouldn't even have an accent. A spokesman at the Russian embassy in Washington declined to comment. I wonder why. Officials in Moscow have previously acknowledged the spy ring, but haven't commented further. All the captured suspects eventually pleaded guilty to acting as secret agents for the Russian government. Now, the key to that sentence is all the captured suspects. Okay? If you catch a couple of spies, it's no big deal. Tim Foley was among the children most extensively groomed for a future spy career, officials say. Though he wasn't American-born, his parents lived in the U.S. for more than a decade under the assumed names Donald Heathfield and Tracy Foley. Mr. Foley was 20 when his parents were arrested. 20 years old. He had been raised in the United States. He was 20 when his parents were arrested and had just finished his sophomore year at George Washington University in the nation's capital. Where one gets caught, 10 get by. His parents revealed their double life to him well before their arrest, according to current and former officials, whose knowledge of the discussion was based on surveillance by the Federal Bureau of Investigation that included bugging the suspects' homes. The officials said the parents also told their son that they wanted him to follow in their footsteps. He agreed, said the officials. At the end of the discussion with his parents, according to one person familiar with the surveillance, the young man stood up and saluted Mother Russia. He also agreed to travel to Russia to begin formal espionage training, officials said. Officials wouldn't say where or when the conversation between Mr. Foley and his parents took place, or whether he made it to Russia before the spy group was arrested. Although, they said he eventually went there. Many details of the investigation remain classified. Peter Krupp, a Boston lawyer who represented Mr. Foley's father in the case, called the U.S. official's account crap. That's exactly a quote. The lawyer said it would have been too risky for the parents to reveal the operation to their son. Mr. Krupp said that since the summer of the spy roundup, Mr. Foley, who wasn't accused of any wrongdoing, has tried to return to the U.S., but unspecified obstacles have prevented him from doing so, and he remains in Russia. I think he'll probably make a trip to Canada or to one of the embassies in Europe, or he may end up working for an American company deals in classified American technology, especially in the computer area. Efforts to find him there were unsuccessful. A lawyer who represented Mr. Foley's mother during the U.S. case didn't return calls seeking comment. Based on their extensive surveillance of the secret agents and their messages to handlers back in Moscow, U.S. counterintelligence officials believe the grooming of Mr. Foley sounds like a neat movie, huh? Was part of a long-term goal for some of the group's children to become spies when they got older. At the time of their arrests, the spies had 7 children, ranging in age from 1 to 20, most U.S.-born. And one agent also had an older son from a relationship before she joined the espionage network. Anna Chapman, the spy who garnered the most attention because of her glamorous looks, didn't have children. Though U.S. officials believe the ring planned to recruit some members' children, not every child was set along this path. One child, a teenager, was allowed to stay in the U.S. after his parents were arrested, and officials said the son isn't viewed as a risk to national security. His father, who went by the name of Juan Lazaro, wanted his son to become a concert pianist, according to a former colleague of the father. A lawyer for the family declined to comment. Most members of the ring were what are known in espionage parlance as illegals, agents who got to a country using a false identity and without official cover, such as a diplomatic position. If caught, illegals have to assume their home country won't come to their rescue. Yes, if you choose to accept this mission, you'll be doing so as a ghost. We will disavow any knowledge that you were there. The spies' false identities, also called legends, were good enough for them to get jobs and mortgages and start families in America, but they weren't airtight. A background check for a job with the U.S. government or a government contractor might have exposed them. The spies were careful not to try to get too close to the heart of U.S. government, according to interviews and court documents. Mr. Murphy, in other words, they were working for McDonald's or maybe a automotive manufacturer. We always need IT guys. Mr. Murphy spoke with an accent and didn't socialize well with his coworkers, according to Mr. Hartley. Difficulties he had blending in at all. G7 group underscore the value agents' children might have to Moscow, being fully Americanized with flawless English. Like, dude, I know exactly what you mean. One purpose of having such agents in the U.S. was to act as go-betweens for other operatives who might have been more closely monitored by U.S. counterintelligence. In other words, they're the bag carriers. They're the messengers. They can travel freely and look like us and sound like us. And, you know, it's hard to profile somebody that looks like us and sounds like us. After the parents were arrested, the children became an important part of the negotiations between Russian and U.S. governments. By the way, in recent news, Russia, not Soviets, but the Russians are pushing Washington, pushing their buttons. They're sailing ships in where ships shouldn't be and doing things that they used to do, which is every time we move one square, they move one square in the opposite direction, no matter where we are. Now, a story that we have talked about from time to time, and it's very, very important and very, very pertinent, because I know each of you have bank accounts. I know each of you work very hard, and saving is rather difficult. And when you do save, you want the people that you save your money with to take good care of it, right? I mean, you don't want them to just go in and take your money out of your savings account and go do something with it, and if they lose it, you don't get it back, right? You want to protect it. You want the FDIC. You want some kind of guarantee that when you put your money in a savings account, it's going to be there when you go get it. You never know when you're going to need a set of tires or your transmission goes out or your son comes to you and wants to go to college and you need to put up some money. That's what that's there for, right? That's why you save it. That's why you do without so that you can put money away for a rainy day. And the story that we covered was about a, you fill in the blank with every bad word you can think of right now, former senator, former governor named John Corzine. He's the head of MF Global. We have just learned this week that guess who his lawyer was? Guess who John Corzine's law firm, the one that represented him in many of these cases. keep in mind, John Corzine, head of MF Global, former senator, former governor, bundler for the current administration, literally stole $1.2 billion, and that's just what they've been able to document. Experts like Ann Barnhart say it's probably closer to $2 billion. Do you have any idea how much money that is? I mean, to put it in perspective, if I were to pay you $1,000 a day, that's a pretty good paycheck, $1,000 a day, $1 million would last you just over 3 years. Okay? Just over 3 years. If I increased your pay to $10,000 a day, $10,000 a day, that's a lot. I mean, most women couldn't spend that much money. The same amount of money, $10,000 for $1 billion, would last you 300 years. Let's give you an idea how much money John Corzine stole from his depositors. Now, most of these deposits, the average size of these deposits, you're not going to believe it. No. It wasn't in the millions. The average deposit size was $10,000. These were not wealthy people. These were farmers and mechanics, bus drivers, school teachers. These were people that trusted their money in a firm called MF Global, that when they wanted to, not MF Global, but the depositor himself, if he wanted to buy and sell a commodity, he could, because he had $10,000 in his cash account. No. This cash was sitting there just like a savings account. They hadn't committed it to anything. Corzine scooped in and took the money. Okay? $1.2 billion, more than likely, it's higher than that. Well, those wondering why the Department of Justice, even after multiple very incriminating testimonies, has refused to go after John Corzine for the vaporization of, now it's up to $1.6 billion in MF Global client funds, need look no further than the documents uncovered by the Government Accountability Institute that reveal, oh, it's coming, wait for it, that the now defunct MF Global was a client of Attorney General Eric Holder and Assistant Attorney General Lanny Brewer's former law firm, Covington and Burling. And now you know. But there's more. Records also reveal that MF Global's trustee for the Chapter 11 bankruptcy, you know, the guy that says you can claim this, but you can't claim that, you have to pay this back, but you don't have to pay that back, that guy, the trustee for the Chapter 11 bankruptcy, retained as its general bankruptcy counsel, Morrison and Forrester, the very law firm from which Associate Attorney General Tony West came to the Department of Justice. Pretty darn stinky, if you ask me. Oh, that's not all. No, there's more. As Government Accountability Institute President Peter Schweizer explains in the Washington Times Thursday of this last week, the trustee overseeing MF Global's bankruptcy is former FBI Director Louis Free. At Holder's Senate confirmation hearing, Free served as a character witness for Holder and revealed that Holder had previously worked for Free. As general counsel, Free said, "I could have engaged any lawyer in America to represent our bank. I chose Eric." Until now, the conventional wisdom for why Holder wouldn't throw the book at Corzine was that Corzine is an Obama campaign bundler. Indeed, as Breitbart News reported, four of the top officials of the Department of Justice, Eric Holder, Thomas Pirelli, Carol Mason, and Tony West, were also big money bundlers for Obama. Cha-ching! But The newly understood crony connections reveal conflicts of interest that extend well beyond mere political support for a common candidate. They go to a tangle of prior business dealings that further underscore the need for a special prosecutor in the Corzine case. Or a good lynching. At least 65 members of Congress have already signed a letter to Attorney General Eric Withholder requesting that he appoint a special prosecutor to investigate MF Global's collapse and the loss, I would say the robbery, of $1.6 billion in customer money. What's more, even progressives have begun to wonder whether Holder's Covington and Burling connection explains why the Department of Justice has not charged, prosecuted, or jailed a single Wall Street executive after the biggest financial collapse in American history. Believe me, it made the crash of 1929 look like an error of deposit with a decimal point. As Richard Escrow of the Huffington Post recently wrote, more and more Washington insiders are asking a question that was considered off limits in the nation's capital just a few months ago. Who exactly is Attorney General Eric Holder representing? As scandal after scandal erupts on Wall Street involving everything from global lending manipulation to cocaine, prostitution, more and more people are worrying about Holder's seeming inaction, or worse, in the face of mounting evidence. This is not going to go away. Both the left and the right are on to Holder's Wall Street head fake. With the revelation of the new crony connections, the time for Eric Holder to appoint a special prosecutor in the Corzine MF Global case is now. Actually, I wouldn't even trust him to appoint a special prosecutor. That would just bury it for at least another year. The election will be long past, and this man and his crew will never be held accountable. And what is also left out of this is the hedge fund activity that's been going on in Washington. Or in Wall Street. Hedge funds, as you know, are designed to prevent material losses based on risky investments that are made in other areas, actual equity investments. The hedge fund is there to hedge against inflation, to hedge against radical movements in the market. Usually, the way that's done is by short-selling stocks. Now, short-selling stocks has been done for a long, long, long time, and most of it in those long times has been legal, but some of it is not. Some of it is called naked short-selling. This is the sale of stock that the company does not have. They're air shares. They're ghost shares. They just go off of the integrity of the firm itself, and they say, okay, well, we're going to sell 100 million shares of this stock into the market at 4 cents a share. Well, there are people out there that are willing to buy that, so they buy it. And guess who the money goes to? That's right. It goes to the firm that sold the air shares into the market. It doesn't go to the company. It goes to them. It goes to the broker. Now, of course, if that share should happen to go up, you know, that company should happen to do better and say the price of the share because of demand or because of earnings, because some market maker evaluates the company and says, ooh, they're pumping 2,000 barrels a day. That stock's worth 8 cents now. Well, what would happen to the short seller is they would now have to go buy that stock, that 100 million shares, the air shares that they sold. But that stock isn't available. There isn't 100 million shares in the market. They made them up. They fabricated them. And so what happens is there becomes a scarcity of supply. And when they have to go buy those shares to own them in order to make the transaction good, because the SEC will require them to do that, if they don't have that, they have to put up the cash. And that's where the hedge fund gets burned. Now, they do this to a couple thousand stocks, so they have 1,800 winners for them and 200 losers. You know, it's just kind of you take the good with the bad. They know what they're doing, and a lot of them are offshore investors. They're in Greece, they're in Europe, they're in Cayman Islands, they're offshore, and the SEC rules don't apply to them. So they have been literally destroying thousands upon thousands upon thousands of small businesses in America that are trading in these penny stock areas or these very low NASDAQ areas. One of the greatest stories out there is a story called Deep Capture. It was written by the guy who runs Overstock.com. Now, Overstock.com is not out of business. They're making money. They're doing very well. But several of the large banks, Citigroup and others, did naked short selling on Overstock.com and tried to drive them out of business. Well, they didn't succeed. They went away licking their wounds. Now, the owners of Overstock.com are suing them for I think it's $400 billion. That's a lot of money. That's nearly $500 billion they're suing them for. If they win, of course, it will be devastating to the hedge funds and good for the owner of Overstock.com. But you don't realize that that's going on every single day. It is also 100% absolutely illegal. But we have not seen one single solitary indictment. Nothing. No arrest, no indictment, nothing in 3.5 years. Nothing. The SEC is being directed by the executive branch to turn a blind eye to all of this operation. Now we know why. Because the very department that's in charge of making these accusations, making these cases, and prosecuting them is in it up to their ears. It is corrupt as anything that we've ever had in Washington. Now, let me just pause just for a moment because I had one of my most faithful listeners, actually in another country, write me this week and say that I was ranting. And I'm really trying not to rant, honestly. I don't want to be considered a ranter. So I apologize for ranting. If I did sound like I was ranting, well, I don't want to rant about it, but you get the idea. I think that we try to do a good service here, and I try to do my best to bring my opinion and my passion to this microphone. This September, we'll be going into our 8th year at BBS Radio. No finer place to be on the planet. The passion and the love that Doug and Don Newsome have for this network goes beyond description. And the integrity is absolutely defensible to the pillars of heaven. So we're trying to do the best job that we can. We're trying to tell the best story that we can. But we're trying to empower you because I want you to protect yourself. I want you to take care of yourself individually. I don't need you to go to Washington with a pitchfork. That's not necessary. That will take care of itself in November. What I want you to do is to protect yourself. And what I've asked you to do in the books and I ask you to do on this program is make sure if your assets are in cash that you have the cash. Okay? Guys like John Corzine are out there, and nobody is going to stop them, okay? But they can't take your cash if it's not in their building, okay? That's what I'm saying. Go get some banker bags very slowly, very carefully. Get your money out of the bank and just keep it somewhere. A mattress is fine. A jar is fine. A box in the garage is fine. Keep it in the trunk of your car. That way you know where it's at. Don't worry about the interest. My gosh, they're not going to pay you 1% interest on that stuff. Now, if you want to take some risks, you know, then take some risks with it. But if you don't want to take risks with it, don't trust those people that are saying that they won't take risks with your money, because they are. They are taking risks with your money. And the second thing is, I want you to put together a small but effective and delicious emergency food supply. Please go to xsquaredradio.com. Right at the top, on the right hand side at the affiliates, we have a brand new affiliate called The Food Investor. What makes more sense than that? Earth Explorers invest in food. This food will keep for 30 years. And it is not this dehydrated, cardboard, non-nutritive cellulose that you get from these survival shops. It is not resold, repackaged, monosodium glutamate-packed stuff that you have to choke down your neck. This food is delicious. And if you don't believe me, you contact them and they will send you a free sample. I promise you. Microwave it, cook on an open fire, stick it in the oven for a minute and eat it, and you'll say, oh my gosh, this is restaurant quality food. While FEMA is out there requiring you to waive your Fifth Amendment rights, they put you in a little tiny unair-conditioned trailer in the middle of a swamp because you didn't bother to take care of yourself. What you need to do is be able to take care of yourself. They are putting together a special 72-hour pack just for X Squared Radio at my request. This is the food supply company that I've been waiting for. This is the food supply company that lives up to the standards that we set here at X Squared Radio. You know we don't have many affiliates. I think I have maybe one or two on there. Why is that? Because they don't take care of you, and they don't take care of me. And that's not the kind of business we do around here. We want you to be taken care of. So please click on the food investors and contact my friends, Scott Barzee, yes, just like the old Barzee Ranch, and Danny Morris. I promise you're going to like these two men. They're good cooks. They have a great idea, and they've got a great home here with X Squared Radio on the BBS Radio Network. Now, let's take a soothing break. Grab something cold and soft, loosen your seatbelt, and get ready for the third hour of X Squared Radio. We'll be right back after this.
Ooh.
And welcome back to X Squared Radio. So glad that you could be here with us tonight. We're coming to you live from east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWeather window forecast about 80 degrees, clear skies. The Aquarid meteor shower is going on as we speak. If you have a view of that outside the almost full moon, then you should be able to see them. Make a wish. Your wishes are powerful. Just wanted to let you know, August 10th, I will be at the Wake Up Now conference in Arizona. Click on the Wake Up Now conference banner at xsquaredradio.com and find out how you can be part of that. I think it's $50 or something, very, very reasonable. Please catch up with me there. Coming up in October, we have three conferences. We have one the 7th, one the 10th, and one on the 21st. All of those are listed on the right-hand side of xsquaredradio.com. Don't forget the Pythagoras conference. That's the granddaddy. Come on, 50 speakers, and it's in the Midwest. It's within driving distance of you. You don't have to have a passport. You don't have to have a plane ticket. You'll get to hear me and all kinds of great speakers there, Michael Cremo and others, and I think you're going to have a great time. Southern Indiana at a resort, a very, very fine venue that Sandra Sabatini has put together. Please join us there. I know you will enjoy it. Representative Ron Paul of Texas, you know, he is the crusader against the Federal Reserve. He's going to retire from Congress at the end of this term. He's been reelected 12 times, and he's done a great job and definitely a legacy. Well, he finally got his bill. Audit the Fed to pass the House. It's true. The Federal Reserve Transparency Act passed the House in a bipartisan. How do I know it's bipartisan? Because it was 327-98, not even close. Republicans and Democrats and independents and libertarians voted for this bill. The bill, according to The Hill, would allow for a full audit of the Fed's monetary policy decisions. This is the first time it has ever been done since it was formed just after World War I, just after Roosevelt appointed the first U.S. head of the Federal Reserve. Democrats argued that auditing the Fed would inject politics into the Fed's decision-making process and be counterproductive, but this assumes that the Fed is somehow not influenced by politics already, which is not the case. Republicans, according to The Hill, have said that in light of the unprecedented actions the Fed has undertaken in recent years, and because Congress has essentially transferred some of its power to the Fed, like to print money, more transparency and accountability are needed. By the way, some of the recent activity would be purchasing some of the U.S. debt. Oh yeah, not just from the U.S. either, from China. That's correct. China cut off its own nose to spite its face by selling off some of the U.S. debt. Why did they do that? Because the U.S. was shipping weapons to Taiwan. And so they did it in protest. Even though the Chinese were making money, interest, off of that debt, they decided to teach the Americans a lesson, and they sold that debt, and the Federal Reserve bought it. Now, what in the world is the Federal Reserve, our monetary administrators, the ones that print dollars and distribute them throughout the world, the ones that set the interest rate, the ones that drive, or should I say, facilitate the driving of the economy by setting monetary policy? What are they doing buying U.S. debt? What's going on? That's what Congress wants to know. And since it is highly unlikely Congress will abolish the Fed, Paul said he hoped making the Fed's decision-making process more transparent will enable Americans to understand how it operates, because we have no idea right now. To audit, we should know what kind of transactions there are, Paul said on the House of the floor. We should know about the deals that they made when they were fixing the price of LIBOR. These are the kinds of things that have gone on for years that we have no access to. Paul's bill, though, is unlikely to go anywhere because it will be blocked by the Senate. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid does not intend to bring up the bill, which means it will never even get a vote in the Senate. 327 of the representatives of Americans of our republic said we want this bill, and one man in the Senate will not even allow the bill to come to the floor for a vote. Regardless, the passage of the Audit the Fed bill in the House nicely caps the career of a congressman who often proclaimed during the Republican primaries that the country, even though it has taken decades longer than he wished, has moved forward toward his views on monetary policy. That's the kind of thing we like to see. Now, we're not without the politics. I'm not going to get all uptight about this conspiracy theory, because it isn't really a conspiracy theory, but I call this the Condi Con. The Condi Con. In this young century, already, we're only 12 years into it, the 9/11 attacks, the global financial crisis, and the unrest of the Arab world have struck in at the heart of vital U.S. interests. I want you to listen closely, because these are not my words. This is the Condi Con. If Americans want the tectonic plates of the international system to settle in a way that makes the world safer, freer, and more prosperous, the U.S. must overcome its reluctance to lead. Oh, be careful, Americans. We will have to stand up for and promote the power and promise of free markets and free peoples, and affirm that American preeminence safeguards rather than impedes global progress. I see. The list of U.S. foreign policy challenges is long, and there will be a temptation to respond tactically to each one. Earth Explorers, do you know what tactically means? No? Yes, okay, one person does. Yes, that's right. Tactically means militarily. That's exactly right. It means with military force. Not the actual force, but the threat of force. But today's headlines and posterity's judgment often differ. The task at hand is to strengthen the pillars of our influence and act with the long arc of history in mind. Yeah, the arc looks a little bit like the edge of a sword. In the Middle East, we must patiently use our aid, expertise, and influence to support the creation of inclusive democratic institutions. Translation. Oh, she even says it right here. Okay, I don't have to translate. Are you ready? The fundamental problem in the region is the absence of institutions that can bridge the Sunni-Shia divide, like that's ever going to happen, and protect the rights of women and minorities. Sounds good so far. Even as we make necessary immediate choices, including, here's the part that doesn't need translating, you'll understand this right away, including arming the Syrian rebels, a la civilians in Nikes and jogging suits, we must insist upon inclusive politics. The U.S. cannot afford to stand aside. Regional powers will bring their own agendas that could exacerbate confessional divisions. Regional powers like Russia, Iran, they're pouring their weapons, helicopters, ships, guns, influence, radio, satellite intelligence, jamming systems. Believe me, arming the Syrian rebels with American weapons and using the townspeople of Syria to fight against the interests that are trying to keep control of Syria is exactly not the thing that we need to be doing. This is what I call the Condi Con. As we work with reformers across the region, we should not forget that Iraq has the kind of institutions that are meant to overcome these divisions. Given its geostrategic importance, the chaos engulfing its neighbors, and Iran's destructive influence, our engagement with Baghdad is sorely needed. Well, keep in mind, Earth Explorers, that we have built the largest airbase in the world in Iraq. We're not leaving. We're staying. The fact that Baghdad is one of the top 50 safest cities in the world is a testament of how tightly we have that lockdown. But Syria is not so safe. I wouldn't recommend a tour of coffee shops in Syria for Americans right now. I'm telling you that those divisions are being fed from all sides because Syria is the crown jewel of the Middle East. So this is what you have. These are the forces you have going on. These are the things that are being said. Skipping ahead, because we got about 40 minutes left in this hour, and there's lots to go over. On a more focused subject, the winner, as sets a world record in archery, was legally blind. Now, I don't know how many of you do blind archery, but blind archery is fun. It's the art of focus. But legally blind archer Im Dong-hyun set the first world records of the London Olympics by breaking his own record in the 72-arrow mark and helping South Korea set a team record in the ranking round on Friday. Im broke the record he had set in Turkey in May by 3 points with a score of 699 hours before the 2012 Games official opening ceremony. "This is just the first round, so I will not get too excited by it," said Im, who has 10% vision in his left eye and 20% in his right. Now that, Earth Explorers, is what I call focus. The 26-year-old Im has said that when he looks at the targets, he sees colors with blurred lines between them. He does not wear glasses in competition, saying he relies on distinguishing between the bright colors of the target. Well, so does everybody else, but they can see 20/20. This is called focus. This is called putting the image into your mind and sending the arrows according to your consciousness, your will. He won gold medals in the team event in the 2008 Beijing and 2004 Athens Olympics. Spectators hoping to catch a glimpse of the action were turned away from Lord's Cricket Ground. Preliminary rounds were listed as non-ticketed, so several thousand spectators showed up at the venue expecting to get in for free. A spokeswoman for the London Games Organizing Committee said tickets were not advertised or sold for the qualifying events, and we have always made it clear that the early competitions were not open for spectators. Seems kind of a shame to have a world record being set in the Olympics and nobody gets to see it. On another fearless subject, a skydiver is getting ready to jump. Now, that's not unusual, except that this guy is jumping from 18 miles up. Skydiver, known as Fearless Felix Baumgartner, has done it again. Wednesday of this week, Baumgartner took another stratospheric leap, this time from an altitude of more than 18 miles, an estimated 96,640 feet, nearly three times higher than cruising jetliners. He landed safely near Roswell, New Mexico. His top speed was an estimated 536 miles per hour, said Brian Utley, an official observer on site. It's the second test jump for Baumgartner from such extreme heights and a personal best, but he's aiming for higher. He's aiming for a record-breaking jump, get this, from 125,000 feet. Or 23 miles high in a month, and he hopes to go supersonic then, breaking the speed of sound with just his body. "It has always been a dream of mine," Baumgartner said in a statement following Wednesday's feat. "Only one more step to go." Yep, that first step is a doozy, too. Longtime record holder Joe Kittinger jumped from 102,800 feet in 1960. That's how long the record has stood. He did it in March. As he did in March, the 43-year-old Austrian ascended alone in an enclosed capsule lifted by a giant helium balloon that took off from Roswell. He wore a full-pressure suit equipped with parachutes and oxygen supply. There's virtually no atmosphere that far up. I bet the view is breathtaking. No pun intended. Last week, or maybe it was a couple of weeks ago, remember we had that remarkable story on the attic where the individuals found the baseball cards that the grandfather had saved. Remember I told you about the baseball card story that me and my cousins used to collect baseball cards, and I had all those baseball cards saved up, and my lovely aunt, thinking of the room that I was taking up in her garage while I was in the Air Force, I came back and she had gotten rid of all the baseball cards. Well, we also talked about the famous Honus Wagner card, the T206 card, in that article. Well, it isn't all glory in this. Bill Mastro, some of you know who he is, I'll explain it in just a moment, and two partners were indicted on fraud charges stemming from massive sports memorabilia scam, including altering famous Honus Wagner card. The T206 Wagner card is the world's most expensive baseball trading card and has fetched millions of dollars in a series of high-profile purchases. By the way, those cards were originally distributed, I believe, with Clorox bleach. It was a free card that came, but it was not very widely printed. It included a $451,000 sale in 1991 to NHL great Wayne Gretzky and a former LA Kings owner, Bruce McNall. Here's the story. A federal grand jury indicted Bill Mastro and two of his business partners on fraud charges Wednesday, alleging that the founder of Mastro Auctions, now you know who he is, and his partners routinely defrauded customers, rigged auctions, and inflated prices paid by unwitting bidders. Mastro, once known as the most important figure in sports memorabilia, is also accused by the United States Attorney's Office in Chicago of altering the world's most expensive baseball trading card, a Honus Wagner T206 that has fetched millions of dollars in a series of high-profile purchases, including a $451,000 sale in 1991, as I described. The card, christened as the Gretzky T206 Wagner after its sale to Gretzky and McNall, was on loan to the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown until March. Its latest sale was to Arizona Diamondbacks owner Ken Kendrick, who paid a record, get this, $2.8 million for the card. The card was sold by Gretzky to Walmart and Treat Entertainment in 1995 for $500,000 for use as the grand prize in a promotional contest and toured the country in a traveling memorabilia museum. It became the first million-dollar baseball card in history in 2000 when Chicago collector Mike Gitwitz sold it for $1.27 million to collector Brian Siegel. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Chicago also said on Wednesday that Mastro and his longtime business associates, Doug Allen and Mark Theodikos, engaged in shill bidding and other deceptive practices in order to inflate prices paid by bidders. Allen was indicted on 14 counts of wire and mail fraud, while Theodikos was indicted on 6 wire and mail fraud counts. Man, can't believe that. Baseball cards. It's nothing sacred. Just goes without saying. Lots of other neat stuff happening. If you've ever driven up I-77 going up to West Virginia, one of the things you'll notice on the side of the road are large billboards. The billboards are paid for by locals. The billboards say, "Welcome to Obama's No Work Zone." Agency government has closed, or is in the process of closing, 175 coal-fired power plants. That's right. Facing declining demand for electricity. I'm not seeing it. I don't see a decline in demand for electricity. Are you? I mean, are you not running your air conditioner about as hard as it'll run today? That's right. I see a show of hands of people that are running air conditioning out there. I don't see a drop-off in demand for electricity. Oh, yes, one other thing. Stiff federal environmental regulations. Coal plant operators are planning to retire 175 coal-fired generators, or 8.5% of the total coal-fired capacity in the United States, according to an analysis by the Energy Information Administration. What? Another administration? A record high 57 generators will shut down in 2012, representing 9 gigawatts of electrical capacity, according to EIA. In 2015, nearly 10 gigawatts of capacity from 61 coal-fired generators will be retired. Do you think we're replacing that electricity? Yes? No? Well, while many of these coal plants are old and relatively inefficient, the scope of this new planned shutdown is unprecedented. The coal-fired capacity expected to be retired over the next 5 years is more than 4 times greater than retirements performed during the preceding 5-year period. The generators that will be retired between 2012 and 2016 are approximately 12% more efficient than the group of units on average that retired during 2009 to 2011. The low price of natural gas resulting from the shale boom has led to reduced coal consumption. They're just running the coal plants off of natural gas. That's how they start them up anyway. But federal and state regulations have also damaged the industry and contributed to plant closures. Here's a quote. The cost of compliance with anticipated and existing federal environmental regulations such as the mercury and air toxics standards, that's called the MATS, is a factor. Particularly in the case of older, smaller units that are not used heavily, owners may conclude that it's more cost-effective to retire the plants rather than make additional investments. Most of the coal-fired generator retirements will occur in the Mid-Atlantic, Ohio River Valley, and the Southeast, hence the billboards that I was telling you about. Now, it isn't just the coal industry, okay? It's more than that. It's way more than that. Now, there is a representative, Mike Kelly, who recently made a brilliant dissertation from the floor of the House. It was so brilliant, and this rarely happens in the House because that's all they do is talk. That's all they do is pontificate and bloviate. But this one drew a standing ovation in regular House business. That doesn't happen very often. It's so rare, it's so special, that I'm going to play it for you right now. You listen to this, and then tell me if what's standing in between you and the success of your small business or starting up your idea is the same thing that he's talking about here. Let's listen in.
For what purpose, gentlemen from Pennsylvania, rise?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I rise in strong opposition to this motion
to
recommit.
Is the gentleman opposed to the motion?
Sir? Yes.
The gentleman is recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In 2011, we came to this House for one reason, and it was a motion to recommit. We recommitted the people of the United States that we were going to change the way business was done in this town. This motion to recommit is a joke. This is ridiculous. Now, let me tell you about what it's like to be in the real world and not inside the Beltway. I operate a business that my father started back in 1953 after being a parts picker in a General Motors warehouse, going to fight the war and coming back home. I called our body shop manager today, Jason Scholes. He's been with me for 26 years. And I said to Jason, I need to know the cost of tape, Jason. He goes, well, what are you talking about, Mike? I said, in our body shop, when people wreck their car and bring their car, and I know we have to use a lot of tape. He says, oh, my goodness, has the cost of tape gone crazy? So we use two types of tape, Mike. We use green tape. Green tape is the tape we use when we have to use water on a job, and we have to make sure that tape sticks. He said, that's up to $4 a roll. I said, tell me about the other tape. He said, well, the other tape is yellow tape. I said, yellow tape? Tell me what the yellow tape does. He said, that's when we're going to paint a car, and we don't have to use the green tape. The yellow tape's a little less expensive. It's only $2 a roll. He said, but Mike, I got to tell you, we're spending $160 a month on tape, and it's really starting to make me wonder about whether I'm doing the right thing. I said, so, Jason, we're $1,000 a year on green and yellow tape. He said, yes, we are. I said, Jason, you know what the cost of red tape is? He goes, I have no idea. We don't use red tape. I said, oh, yes, we do. It's $1.75 trillion. That's the cost of red tape. And I called my friend Don Shamey at Next Tier Bank, and I said, Don, we've known each other since we were kids. Our wives know each other. Our kids grew up together. We do a lot of things together. I've done business with you for 40 years. You're right across the street from me. Don, tell me about the new regulations. He said, well, Mike, if you take a look at it, there's 1,100 pages now that are the definition of whether you're a qualified borrower or not. I said, it only took 1,100 pages for the government to determine what the definition is of a qualified buyer. Are you kidding me? Do you mean to sit here and say that you are serious? We renovated a ballpark in my hometown. A guy named Tom Bernatowski, veteran. Took us a couple $1 million to renovate our ballpark. The day we were going to open up, I got a call at the dealership and said, Mike, would you come down? I said, why? What's going on? He said, we're having trouble with the occupancy permit. So I went down to see. I said, so what's the problem? He said, well, here, come in the men's room. Let me show you what the problem is. I said, we have 1,500 people who want to come see the opening ball game. They said, yeah, but we've got a major problem. You see, the mirrors in the restroom are a quarter of an inch too low. Oh, my God. So you can't possibly open that ballpark. So you want to know the price of regulation? You want to talk about the thousands and thousands of pages that we put on the backs of the job creators? You want to talk about creating jobs in America? When you want to see a nation that doesn't want to participate but wants to dominate in the world market, then let them rise. Take the heavy boot off the throat of America's job creators and let them breathe. The jobs we are talking about are not red jobs or blue jobs. They are red, white, and blue jobs. They are not Democrat jobs or Republican jobs or independent jobs or libertarian jobs. They are American jobs. If you want this country to thrive and not just survive, then please start playing the game by the rules and stop this ridiculous mockery of what it is that we do here in this town. We are so out of touch with the American people. And you know what all this does? It adds layer after layer after layer of cost. And that cost is ultimately paid for by the American consumer. You want to have more revenues? Then let the tide rise for all boats. Let us be able to not only survive, but to thrive. I urge all my colleagues on both sides now, this is not a left or right issue. This is an American issue. I urge you to rise today and vote for H.R. 4078. Let's let America get back to work. And with that, I yield back.
And that's what I'm talking about. That was an impassioned speech on the floor of the House. That's what that's about. Now, the interesting thing is that here is a committee chairman who is making this statement that it is these onerous regulations that are keeping America's job creators from going back to work. You're probably in that situation as well. You have an idea, you have a small business, you have a farm, you have something that you want to bring to market and make yourself successful and your family and your community and to get your idea out there to make life better for others. But you can't do it because the regulations from one agency, department, bureau, or administration or another are in your way. Well, Congress is feeling this frustration as well. If you could watch the video and see Representative Mike Kelly hold up in his hands something like 1,000 pages of regulations that only have to do with what a qualified borrower is for the bank. There are an average of 600 new regulations a month being written, not by Congress, not by the ones that you elected and sent to Washington, but by what you call bureaucrats. These are professionals whose job it is to what? Keep us safe by making sure the mirrors in a restroom of a renovated baseball stadium are a certain height off the floor, and if they're a quarter inch too low, you don't get the occupancy permit? Are you kidding me? 1,500 people standing outside ready to see a baseball game, and they can't get a CO to let people in the front gate because the mirrors in the bathroom are too low. That is when regulations become ridiculous. The mirrors have been just fine in baseball diamonds for 100 years. There's no sense in this. There's no honor in this. And legally, there's no representation in this. So when we have a government that is operating without our permission, that has taken rights away and is standing in between the success that we dream of and us, it has to go. Now, the question is, how do you make it go? Well, I wrote a book on that called Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty. Many of you have read it. You've already commented on it. By the way, if you've read the book, please go to Amazon and fill out a review of the book. I would really appreciate it. Other buyers and potential buyers of the book would appreciate it. It only takes you 5 or 6 minutes. Go and fill out the make a comment on Alienated Nation. Help us get back up in the top 20. By the way, that book made it to number one in our genre, which is pretty respectable. We just want to keep it there. We also want to get the word out because this is not a book that's advocating a revolution, not that kind of revolution. We already know that 40 states have passed their individual sovereignty acts. That takes a lot. That takes a lot for local communities to send their local senators to the state house, for them to argue it out on the floor. Some of them took years, some of them took months. But then finally they passed their sovereignty acts. And a lot of these are in the book because they're so poignant, they're so powerful, they're so declarative. And the fact that 40 states have done it is significant because it takes 75% of the states to call, or I'm sorry, two-thirds of the states, 67% of the states, to call a constitutional convention. Now, it's never been done before. The last one that we had was the one called at the ratification of the Constitution. Madison was the one that led it. We've made amendments to the Constitution, but those have been done through congressional amendments, and then those amendments go out to the states to be ratified. It takes 75% of the states to ratify. But it only takes 67% of the states to call their own constitutional convention. They don't need Congress. They don't need the Senate. They don't need the president. 67% of the states can call it. We have 80% of the states that have already passed sovereignty acts. We get these 40 states to put 40 delegates together, one delegate each. They come together at a state house, a university, or a mutual place of meeting. Televise it if you have to. Agree on the agenda ahead of time so it's not a brawl. And repeal 3 amendments, pass 5 more amendments, and you're finished. And as soon as the Constitution is finished, you turn right around and ratify, and in one day, this whole thing could be finished. The agencies that now control the United States of America will be taken from power in one afternoon without firing a shot, without doing anything that is unconstitutional or unlawful. And once that agency government is taken from power, from ruling, not governing, from ruling the United States of America, then and only then can small business begin to start hiring people, putting people back to work, creating the revenue engine that made this country great, that made the world great. We have a ton of great products and a ton of great things that need to go out there to the world, and they originate right here in America. We want to go to work. We want to go to work. We want to do our best and put our product out there. None of these products are dirty. None of these products are unsafe. All of these products are needed by Americans. Americans want them. They're desiring them. And all I can tell you is this is where we want to go. This is what we want to do. We want to have this constitutional convention. Now, what does it take? What do we have to do here? Well, the first thing that we have to do is we've got to get the 40 states to talk. We got to get representatives from each of the 40 states together. Well, people, this can be done in an afternoon, okay? All you have to do is call your governor's office and tell them that you support the idea of a constitutional convention. You can make this happen. You can do it because you're John Q. Public. And your phone calls and your letters go a long, long way to making this kind of thing happen. And I'd like to see it happen. I know you would too. It's a strong and powerful move. It's bold. And I don't think there's anybody out there that doesn't agree that it is going to take something bold to make this happen. It just is. And this is peaceful. It is bold, but it is peaceful. And I think we can... I think we can make this happen. I think you and I together can make this happen. Everything great in history started with a small group of people. In fact, as the story goes, nothing great ever started any other way. We don't need millions of people to do this. We only need the listeners of this program, X Squared Radio. That's what we're here to do. We're here to alter the course of the universe. In fact, it could be said that you and I, we're on course to do this. This is why we came here, because the exercise, the experiment that is called the United States of America is the proper way for people to be governed, period. I don't care what religion you are. I don't care what race you are. I don't care what language you speak. These are unalienable rights that we have to speech, to press, to bear arms, to protect ourselves, to keep ourselves free, and to pursue our own version of happiness as long as it doesn't harm someone else's. That's what I'm talking about. Right now, we have an agency government that is preventing 300 million Americans from doing that. The only ones that are being allowed to move forward are doing so at a dear, heavy cost. They have to give money back to the system. The corruption and the level of plutocracy, by the way, means that you basically have criminals in office. And if you don't pay protection to the criminals, you don't do the things the criminals tell you to do, and pay them heavily to get the privilege, then you're not going to be allowed to operate. You're not going to be allowed to cross the street. You're not going to be allowed to read a book or put something up on the internet that you think people should read, or to make a movie, or to build a building, or to build a road, or to write a program. Any of the things that you think that you can create, that you can do, you're not going to be allowed to do it. Because some agency in the government is going to decide that you can't do that. Some large billion-dollar multinational corporation does not want you to compete against them. And so they contact the agency government and tell them, you keep these small businesses out of my market. I want it all. I want to set the price. I want to set the surface capability. And I don't want anybody competing with me with a better product at a better price. And that's what the agency government is there to do. Now, you heard Representative Mike Kelly express his frustration. He's not a freshman. He came to Washington to make a difference, but you can hear his frustration. And you can hear the support of the frustration by those congressmen and women who were behind him in the background, rousing him on, cheering him on. Because they are all facing exactly the same thing. Earth Explorers, we are not the enemy. The United States of America is not the enemy. Congress is not the enemy. Yeah, they have the low rating because the press likes to use them as a scapegoat because they can't get anything done. But I'm telling you right now, it's not their fault by and large. Now, the leadership, yes. The Harry Reids of the world, absolutely. Take action. take action in the polling booth and take them out. It can be done. It can be done. A third of the Senate can be replaced in less than 100 days. That's right. And if you really want to, the entire House of Representatives can be done. It could happen. It could happen. But I suggest you start at the top of the ranks and not the bottom. But all the voting in the world won't do a bit of difference. Nothing. It'll do nothing if we cannot remove the agency government from power. The secretaries, the czars, the administrators, the directors, they have to go. The problem is they're not elected. They're not accountable. You have no representation in these, none whatsoever. You're being taxed, you're being charged a fee, and you're being fined, you're being prosecuted, and laws or regulations are being written with the force of law every single day, without representation. That is tyranny, my friends, absolute tyranny. I'm not ranting, I'm telling you the truth. Now, we can sit here and close our eyes and fold our arms and take our tennis shoes off and bow our head and march through the line and take another dose of radiation. Or you can say enough is enough. It's time for the Constitutional Convention. This can be over and done with in a single day, my friends. This is not a large mountain to climb. It is something that can be organized very quickly, can be put together in less than 30 days. The vote can happen, done, finished. The agency government, the government that is now ruling the United States of America, and by and large ruling the free world, heading us straight for war. And I read you the Condi Con, so you know what the feeling is. You know the official text now. We're going to send weapons into other countries that we do not have soldiers in, we do not have a presence in, but we're going to send their citizens weapons so they can fight a war that will result in a government that's more favorable to us. That's how we spread democracy. That's how we spread the ideals of the United States of America. Are you kidding me? Yes, we are kidding you. That's the Condi Con. That's what I'm trying to tell you. That's the plan. That's the imperial plan. Send weapons into countries so that the citizens can go fight against professional troops. Send more shoulder-fired rockets. Send more computers. Send more firearms and bombs so that the citizens of Syria can go fight the armies of Syria and Russia and Iran. But our interests will be seen to be advanced if the Syrian government can be toppled and the people can take control. Tell me, do you think that's happening in Egypt? Do you think the American agenda of democracy and freedom and the Bill of Rights is being advanced in Egypt? Really? From a president who has publicly said, Mr. Morsi, President Morsi has said he's going to take the pyramids down block by block. He's going to destroy them because they are idols of the infidel. Are you serious? That's what I'm talking about. The agency government has to go. Buy the book, alienatednation.com. You get the audiobook for free when you order, and I will send it to you autographed, or buy it at Amazon. And if you do, please go there and write a review. Barnes & Noble, it's available in Nook and Kindle. You can listen to it. I've got it in audio. All of those things are available. Tell a friend. Let's build the momentum. The small audience of X Squared Radio can change everything. What do you say? Well, I will probably see you next week as we get ready for the next trade show. Keep the faith, Earth Explorers. Don't forget to go outside and look at the Aquarid meteor shower tonight. It's peaking. If you can get by the nearly full moon that's out there. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. Don't forget, we love you. Remember, you are Source. Look for the good in others every day and help it to grow. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio saying peace, Earth Explorers.
X Squared Radio is brought to you by